Okay, is this working? All right, thank you. Just want to begin with acknowledgement of country, and I wish to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which this paper was prepared. And I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend this respect to all Indigenous people present at this conference. So, textiles play an important part in the worship experience in many Christian churches. Scripture suggests that fine textiles in the worship space is what God desires. For example, the God of Exodus says, "You shall speak to all who have ability, who have endowed with skill, that they make Aaron's vest to consecrate him for my priesthood." Sewing makes a very early entrance into the Christian literature, in the book of Genesis, when Adam and Eve discover they are naked and sew together fig leaves to clothe themselves. However, those sewn artefacts associated with Christian worship and spirituality have been extensively documented, the spirituality of sewists, or the people who sew, has received very little attention. So I'm going to look at three aspects in things I want to look at in this paper. Stitched up worship, what I'm going to call, worship as part of mission and service, and worship, sewing as facilitating a Christian lifestyle. I'm not sure if Ian Radvan is here. He's at the conference. The stole on the left is the stole I made for him. The one on the right is one I made for another friend. In the book of Exodus, as I've said, God proclaims that his priests shall be dressed in garments made by people with skill. Well, for centuries, devout women, and I say that it's predominantly been women, but not only, have stitched vestments worn in worship, and typically these are gifted to aid the ministry of an individual or community for whom they are made. In addition to demarcating liturgical celebrants, the images incorporated on vestments can provide a visual depiction of the central themes of worship and or establish a space as a place of worship, and have sometimes been described as, quote, sermons in thread, end of quote. Whereas the making of vestments is perceived as requiring specific expertise, the making of altar linens often been a task to which large numbers of women have traditionally been involved as part of their contribution to church life. Similarly, in some churches, the sewing of kneelers has been open to anyone interested in participating, including novice sewers. Whether or not those involved in the stitching of kneelers understand it's their mission, it certainly requires a significant dedication of time. According to one website, which produces kits, an average kneeler is approximately 13 inches by 10 inches with a height of 3 inches, with a minimum of 100 stitches per square inch, and some of them have even finer noting. Given that the kneeler involves not only the top but the sides being stitched, a kneeler of these dimensions, my calculation, required 26,800 stitches to complete, and some require many more than that. And I was reading about a lot of kneelers that I think required around 150,000. It was a big kneeler, but also was a very fine gauge. So some of them are up to 18 by 18 per square inch. So that's a lot of stitches. So stitched-up worship. Sewing as mission. Sewing artefacts for worship is not the only way in which stitchers utilise their skills as part of their missional service to the church. For many sewers, making or repairing items for people in or beyond their own circles is intrinsic to who they are and how they perceive their place in the world. Sewing circles have long been organised by local churches and have traditionally provided women with opportunities to share their faith as they bonded over a shared interest in sewing. Many of these groups created objects that were provided to people in need in their communities, while others created items of clothing for missionaries to distribute. Whether they meet with others or sew alone, women still contribute to the wider world through sewing. Through membership of craft groups, Christian women may create objects which they donate to local charities or sell as part of their fundraising. Christian souls also make contributions to their creation directly to charitable organisations, such as groups which distribute quilts to women and children who've become homeless as a result of domestic violence. When the prophet Job has sewed sackcloth upon my skin, the soul's results are not always virtuous. Indeed, the prophet Ezekiel speaks on behalf of God in denouncing women who sew inappropriate apparel. The need for women to dress modestly continues to be proposed as a reason why women should learn to sew, and there's some blogs that are out around that, fairly recent ones. But such sentiments can present as up being not unlike that of the Pharisees, who thanked God that they were not evildoers. In contrast, many soloists report that their stitching enables them to enter into a space in which they can engage as spiritual beings. The rhythm or repetition of stitching may enable the time spent sewing to be concurrently used to focus or reflect on other concerns, including meditating on religious texts or prayer. When Jesus claimed it would be easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to attain eternal life, he was speaking in words which a soulist would readily understand. But although Jesus spoke of threading a needle, sewing has received relatively little recognition as being a way of finding God and engaging in a life of faith. Finally, a spirituality of sewing is not a spirituality not just about the final product, but about the process of creation and failure to understand the potential association between spirituality and activities such as sewing is ultimately a failure to take seriously the role of embodiment in the spiritual life. And I have some questions for us. Some questions to think about. If the body of Christ is essential to Christianity, why are embodied expressions of spirituality, such as sewing, often considered inferior to in spiritualities, which are essentially of the mind? Is sewing for worship more spiritual than sewing for other purposes? And as I was looking at the some choir vestments recently that had recently, all the hems were falling down, I was wondering if the creation of ornate vestments or banners is more spiritual than fixing the falling hems on the choristers' robes. Is lack of recognition of sewing as spiritual a reflection of religious cultures which often bestow higher status to the contributions of males or tasks which are typically undertaken by males? And it then is not recognising sewing as potentially spiritual a reflection on sexism in the broader society? And is it possible to have a spirituality involving sewing that is not, quote, motivated either by austerity cultures or by a form of nostalgic and regressive conservatism? So that's some questions for us to think. Or you might have other ideas, but yeah.
Thank you very much. That's lovely. How do you want us to take this?
Well, I'm over for people to respond as they'd like to.
That's great. Thank you. Yes.
So, I don't know. You've seen a year ago, people were knitting scarves, climate scarves. Mm. So I took mine to church. And knitting away, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, I've never seen anyone knitting in church. Strange thing to say. I mean, I had a purpose, I wanted to talk about climate change and why I was doing it. And you get those kind of questions asked, just, what are you doing? So,
what did you say? Mind your
business. I'm thinking about the words. So I worship more, being more spiritual than sewing for other purposes. All I can say...
I'm not saying it is, I'm just raising the question.
I've just made myself a coat, which for those who aren't Anglican or Catholic, is a cavish kind of thing. It was very ornate, with the orphreys all decorated with applique and machine embroidery, which a friend, we were collaborating on it, and I had the wild beast, the Holy Spirit, on the back. And I swore just as often, making the coat as I swear making the dress that I'm wearing. So, you know, I don't think it's more spiritual.
I use this often, so I'm just wondering whether it's perceived as more spiritual by others.
Oh, sure, it's more perceived as being more spiritual.
I think two thoughts occur to me. One is, I think I can feel women's containment through so.
Absolutely.
You know, that you can do something really nice and, sort of calm. And, yeah, and the other thing that really interested me is this introduction of a hierarchy of sewing. If you sew, I love that question. Whether you sew for if you sew sort of ornate things with the sort of gold thread, is this somehow holier than if you do the hems of fine things?
Well, the ornate vestments are seen. Nobody notices things like hems. If hems have been, but nobody notices when they've been fixed. So it's the.
And it's the idea of maintenance rather than creation, which is often the woman's role, isn't it? That role is to, maintain rather than to do innovative things.
Mm. There was a comment over here.
How you got the opportunity to put this together? Or is this
I'm an academic. I teach social work. I'm the professor of social work at Deakin University. But I like sewing. And a few years ago, I got into sewing, and I've been reflecting for a while on why I actually found sewing to be of interest. So I started looking. So I started exploring the literature. Starting to explore the literature on spirituality, and so this is one of a couple of papers I've written recently. So looking at what does it mean, and why do I find this more a more interesting way of sewing is a more interesting way of expressing my spirituality and who I am than perhaps the ways that I've traditionally engaged in spirituality, which is very wordy.
That last question, I was just thinking about that kind of contemplative, meditative, repetitive things, certain forms of handwork, you know, that people actually often do use as a form of becoming in touch with themselves, slowing their mind down, bringing that restfulness, which is inherently connects them to their sense of spirituality. And for me, that raises the question of if this is an experience of a number of people, how do we invite others or promote this or encourage this and value it?
Thank you so much. This is really amazing and great. I love all your questions that bang on. And a few years ago, I experienced spiritual, physical, and mental healing through doing a cross stitch. I was just going to ask as well, how does consumerism flow into this? Because we all know things are cheaper at Kmart than they are. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I haven't touched on those things in this part. I've touched them else. I think, there was a whole, a generation just a little bit older than me. When I talk to women in their 70s or older, they all tell me that when they were younger, they used to go off and would sell all their clothes. Now they don't do it anymore. It was an economic necessity. It sort of when clothing became cheaper in sort of the 70s and 80s, and it became much more economic to make. So a lot of people decided, you know, they didn't need to. So there was sort of an austerity factor for a lot of people. It was a chore. I mean, for many women historically, sewing's been a chore that they did to keep their families clothed. Now it's much more of a choice. And it's actually, it's not necessarily cheap to sew.
Unless you recycle.
Yeah.
That's right. My garment. You recycle.
But it's not always cheap. But it can be an inexpensive thing depending on what people do and what they want to do. It's much more, it's a choice now for many people rather than a, And I think that's changed the dynamic. And a lot of people have, you know, so there's now a new generation of people coming through who perhaps have never experienced all their clothes, almost all their clothes being made by the family, either to their horror or sometimes to their delight if you had good sewers in the family, but sometimes to their horror. And discovering that it is something they can do. It's a way of expressing their own identity by making their own clothes, or making clothes that fit, but also making things that they want to wear and want to do. So I make a lot of my own clothes. I'm not wearing clothes that I made this week. But it's fun and it's exciting and to do something a bit different.
You can't see any.
Yeah.
I just wonder, I do a lot of sewing out of love for my children, my grandchildren, and I've made, you know, I've got 13 grandchildren, and I've made them all a rug that I've embroidered. And I put myself into that. I also make them a quilt that goes on their beds, so that, you know, so I just wonder, you know, for me, sewing is about love and about the person, the other, rather than, I'm not doing it for myself, but it is that, as Rachel said, that lovely, quiet, calm.
Yeah, and also about being gifting yourself to others, and I see that as part of mission. It's part of we gift ourselves to others by what we make and give.
Without having that purpose or that love in it, to me, I don't think I could just do that. But you know, it's always about making a dress for my daughter or things for my grandchildren.
Yeah. And I think we all sew for different reasons, and at different times I will sew for different reasons at different times. So I think, you know, it's not something that's sort of it's the same for everybody. So it's not people. So it's important not to generalise for everybody.
And religious, it's not. I don't think it's sort of religious sewing and other sewing. I think it's all about just sewing for a religious purpose. It's all about loving what you're doing it for. You know, doing it out of duty.
I have to say, when my husband died, sewing was the only thing that kept me functioning, really. I sewed a huge amount. I was working by day, but sewing by night, and it was the thing that enabled me to hold together.
It could also be a protest, like the going back to mending instead of going to landfill, or making bootleg jeans into craft aprons and people buy them. So it's kind of it creates meaning.
Was there anything going on for you explicitly spiritually when you were sewing the stoles or anything?
I think it depends. I've made quite a few stoles for people, and some I've made just with that, and I've just sent to them for friends, and others I've made on request. I think it's about placing your. It's about something about thinking about that person, what they're doing with it, what they'll do, what it's. It's about time of reflection, and each of them's probably been a bit different. So some of them. I made out of that. That's another stole I made for a friend of mine who'd just become provincial with his order, and I like the fact that these fish, especially on the left, some of them most of them going one direction, but there's a few going the other direction. And I thought, you know, as a provincial, he's going to have a few. He's going to have to find leadership with engage in leadership with people going in different directions.
Not being able to, but the good time that you've got on conversation, I'm sure you'll be open to other conversations, won't you? So thank you very much.
Thank you. One to follow this, I did my thesis and did sewing as part of my thesis
in theology, so yeah.
Yeah.
I've already loaded it. Yes, all good. So No, I'll just wait for people to run away. Try not to feel insecure. No, no. It's fine. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You're all leaving me.
Could you just shut the door to just be sent for it?
Okay.
Hey, warm welcome to Miriam. And so we can send you the number. You've brought this letter.
Thank you. Tēnā koutou katoa, ka mihi a hau ki te atua, te kaihanga nunui, ka mihi a hau ki te mana whenua o tēnei rohi, nā gāna tangata, ko Moana Nui a Kiwa, te Moana, ko te Waipounamu, te whenua, ko Miriam Jesse Fisher tōku ingoa. So first of all, I start by greeting God, who is the great creator of all things. And my second greeting is to the Kaurna people, who are the custodians and leaders of this land. My ocean is the Pacific, and my land is the South Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand. So, Leviticus might seem an unusual location to start a conversation about contemplative life, community conversation, and art making, but here we are. So I locate my conversation today around the sowing and gleaning principles that are found in Leviticus 19 and again in 23. And I start here thinking about how we might consider our offerings in the world, a world that might be one of poverty and a need for spiritual companionship, a place where a seeker might find sustenance. The rules around gleaning included provisions to ensure that specific pieces of the field were left. This meant that the poor were able to glean simultaneously with landowners and workers. Contextually, gleaning asks no questions of worthiness. There is no gatekeeper to the field. For the Israelites, their practices are to be directly aligned with their espoused values, and there's no room for a private interpretation of those values. The field must have gleaning spaces. And whether those sections are gleaned or not, there's a clear imperative that they are not the belonging of the rich landowner, but that all things and all people receive from God's own offering. Generosity is explicitly considered a way of enacting faith. If communities of faith could articulate the role of the arts in reaching out to connect with or serve the community through truth-telling, highlighting beauty and hope, then the role and status of those who are art makers may be enlarged, even as a vision for reaching out to a dislocated community may be revisioned. Faith is not just enacted in the temple and the sanctuary, but also in the field and the town. It is a beautiful provocation that regardless of our vocational location, our spiritual values are embedded into our daily living. It highlights that each member of the faith community has a role to play in its social capital, and this is part of the way in which holiness is enacted. So in moving these and using these holiness commands, and the practices of contemplative artists, I make the following links. That works of art may be first brought into focus as a purposeful and beautiful way to leave the abundance of our faith as a location for the modern seeker to engage with. And that art practitioners may find that their work is seen as something that genuinely contributes to the faith community and to their broader community. There are two caveats I want to say, though, in naming those things. First is that gleaning comes from the abundance. Too often with our artists, they are expected to do the work for free. Abundance, the livelihood is made, the abundance is offered. Generosity is a posture of the heart, and it is not for the community to demand free access. As a portion of the field is left which is directly related to the size and abundance, so then the artwork offered and the fullness of contemplative disclosure will be related to the individual's circumstances. Secondly, in capitalist societies, we are what we produce, and productivity and the monetary potential of it have become the measure of human success in the world. We must sing a different song. So productivity is not the goal of prayer or a burden we place on our artists. The slow life, infused with wonder and awe and characterised by a contemplative value system, must be wrestled for intentionally. Art, both making and contemplation, I think, can teach us how to see and how to speak to one another. Art making is a slow process in a high-speed world. It offers the opportunity to know something deeply and intimately. It involves the body and the mind. It cannot be separated from the spiritual life. Artists are freely willed participants of his essence, participating in the triune life of God and receiving inspiration from that source. Making art is often an experience of gratuitous grace. The outcomes reveal more than expected. New revelation comes from the work, and from a contemplative posture, art is an offering that tunes into the whisper of God and gives back from the abundance of that moment, not for the critical gaze, but to the subject of the work. Art making teaches the maker that prayer can be embodied in action. While silence, stillness, and solitude are often part of contemplation, the incarnation serves as our model, reminding us that physical embodied practice is essential to avoid what I would call the danger of a cerebral-only prayer life. Making is a process of prayer and not an outcome to be attained. The perfect artwork is not a contemplative prayer modality. Otherwise, the temptation is to productivity and perfection, which easily encroaches on the contemplative prayer, and adoration turns to achievement to be accomplished and an audience to impress. In a world that speaks at cross purposes, that enacts cancel culture before the conversation has even had a chance to begin, art can make space. Art can be a demilitarized zone where some new kind of conversation might have an opportunity, I think, to bloom in the silence. Art speaks a universal language. People experience the world through their senses, and art speaks in sensory language. In this way, art might steal across borders and speak a common language. The arts, I think, can be conversation partners and starters. Art can be a gleaning space, humbly offered. This will take creativity, innovation, perhaps risk, certainly, but we are called to generosity and trust. We do not claim to know who is hungry or even what they need. We simply leave the bounty of our life to be gathered up by whoever wants it. This kind of freedom enacts a deep trust in God, whose actions turn marginal items into miracles. Earth into humans, and mud into eyes that see. Arts wait to be touched, tasted, seen, heard, smelled, and it is part of the artist's role to draw attention to the order of things and to their disorder. There is a humility in this, even when works are provocative. Artists open a door to a conversation. They set a table. They offer hospitality. They make space for the other to have a role in the dialogue. Their voice bends low and whispers, "Do you see this too?" Power and agency remains with the person who chooses to join the conversation, to stop, to see, to consider. The maker cannot demand the conversation be entered a certain way or that certain assumptions will be drawn. We must let go of the control of telling people how to behold and what to think about in their stopping. We must trust that the Spirit speaks. In the gaps, in the space between the viewer and the art piece is a sacred space, one where God can speak. It could be argued that an offering contemplative artwork into the community might also, I think, shape people for the practice of contemplation. As they behold a seen thing, they become made ready to behold an unseen reality. I pivot briefly here to a project called Pocket Wisdom. Demonstrates art making as a contemplative practice and seeks to be a gleaning space for contemplation. A woman paces, waiting for an oral examination that will determine her ability to progress in her studies. Her nervous energy makes it impossible for her to be still. She paces up and down the hall. On a wall nearby, 25 handkerchiefs stitched with short quotes are pinned to a wall with dressmaker's pins. The breeze in the hallway moves them and they flutter unexpectedly, capturing her attention. She moves toward them, momentarily distracted, forgetting the tension in her breathing. She begins reading one and then another. Her body language changes. She is still before the work. Her shoulders have lowered. She is breathing deeply. She is, for several minutes, present to the moment and absent to her swirling thoughts and stress. Her gaze is fixed on a physical object reaching toward an unseen reality. Pocket Wisdom uses second-hand discarded handkerchiefs, thread and needle to speak in ways to unseen realities and longings. These were installed in my academic institution. A visual and physical, they hung out from the wall and moved whenever a breeze went past them. In the creation of Pocket Wisdom and its social and public location, people were able to walk past without taking any notice. They were able to remain with it, reading it, or return to it. The public location was left as a gleaning space over which I had no control. Stillness that included movement. Silence that included the sound of thread as it passes through fabric. Spiritual meditation that includes the body, the sight, the feel of the fabric, the needle and the thread were part of making this work. This practice allows my eyes to focus on a work so that my spirit might be focused on the words beyond the work. My focus entirely directed into the work of my hands, stitch on stitch, my heart is at prayer and at play. These are tangible offerings of my loving gaze, demonstrating art practice when combined with a contemplative lens might become an extension of liturgy, of offering self to a community and practice of confession, worship, celebration, prophetic truth-telling, lament, and more. As these are left as gleanings in the world, they offer a way to communal practices for seekers around them. What is the abundance of our lives? Will we offer it? How might we make pieces that offer seekers a way to connect with God, to experience the transcendence in the everyday? The act of leaving our abundance reminds us we are rich too. We have ways to participate in the ecclesial life. The act of receiving from them reminds us that the life we are called to is interdependent. We each contribute. We each receive. We might meet God through the work of others. So I thought I would just take a few seconds to actually just offer us some silence to think about the first question. How do you offer the abundance of your life for gleaning by others? And then we'll talk about those. But just take a few moments of silence to think about that question. Second part, having been here with some of you in the first session, there's some great thoughts and ideas in the room. So actually what I'm going to ask you to do, I'm going to use a timer on my phone and I'm just going to set the timer for 3 minutes and ask you to talk with someone else about these two questions so that there's some discussion and then perhaps we'll draw back together. So I'll put a timer on my phone, but please, I teach teachers, we use turn and talk. So turn and talk means you can talk to two or three or whoever. Just turn and talk to someone nearby. And I'm going to put a timer on. Can you read them? I was like, are they too small?
And the main expression that we do is that through
This is the thought that I offer you to take away with you in as you go into your communities of seekers and your communities of faith. Have you considered embodied prayer as a way to connect with God, yourself? And also, would you consider offering that to those you accompany on their spiritual journey? Certainly for me, being allowed to do that has been very transformational. And then just any other questions, thoughts, connections, resonances, exciting things. Clearly I work in stitch, but when I say art, I mean dance, sculpture, photography, music, sound, all writing. Of those things. Writing, yes, poetry. So I work with poetry as well, spoken word. Yeah.
I write novels.
Yes, oh, fantastic. Yeah.
As well as stitch.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a thought, it seems like some people get really worried, like if you're going to go into music or dance, oh, it might get a bit off track, whereas this feels like it could be a safer,
yeah.
Like, oh, you can't go wrong if it's just knitting or stitching, yeah. But mm-hmm. You know, then you've got your quotes there that are just like, yeah. So thought-provoking.
And lovely and feminine.
Oh, lovely and safe, yes, safe.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
For some of the unpicker is the absolute most important tool.
Yeah. Yes. I think, I mean, I agree with you. My background is actually in drama and acting work. And so growing up, certainly there was a fear of, like, the evils of the acting world. My thing is, Jesus doesn't turn away from communities. Jesus goes into communities. And I think if we cannot carry ourselves with generosity, like, for me, the thing I think I love about the arts is the arts are generative. They're self-giving. They offer themselves in one of, I think it might have been in this article, like the large article that I did. I call the arts naked and generously so. And that's the thing for me, actually. When you go to theatre or whatever, your barriers are all down. It's very different than coming to a church service and thinking, oh, they're all going to get my money or they're going to do whatever. You know, like all the things that people might bring with them to that.
Yeah.
When I say to a friend, will you come to an art exhibition with me? They come to that in a way that, and that's where I think for me there's the triangle of the art maker, the piece, the viewer, and within that I think that's where the Holy Spirit is doing the holy work that we don't always know. yeah, the little triangle. So I think yes, I understand that, but I do not think that we should shy away from arts communities or artists. And for, you know, when you walk down the street and you hear someone playing something beautiful, that just, for me, that's offering the gleaning of our lives. It's saying the field and the town, which is what Leviticus is saying, those are places where holiness is enacted too, not just in the sanctuary and the temple. But I hear what you're saying. I think I live in that space sometimes. And whilst I'm doing textile work, one of my textile pieces was about Mary Magdalene for my thing, and it was a double-sided quilt, sort of, you know. And on one side it says First Apostle, and on the other side it says Repentant Whore. You know, and I was looking to disrupt narratives that had been applied to her incorrectly. So I don't think that textiles, and like the work of SJSA Academy, so that's all about social justice, telling stories and being provocative for me is not separate from women's work. And you know.
Yeah, it feels like a safe way in.
Yeah.
For people who wouldn't cope with this.
Yeah. Yes, yes, and that's the thing for me. Like, I feel like if those little hankies, which obviously I brought with me, you could just pin them somewhere. And that thing of like, I did a lot of op chopping for those hankies. But yeah, I put a little photo of them up there for you. But yeah, I think.
So, what's the equivalent in a church to make that? So you've got the creator,
yeah.
The work,
The
us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You mentioned resonances. Our church, which is a church about 900 years old, we have for the year 2000, different parts of the community did a small embroidery and appliqué of what they did. So the village hall did some, the pub did one, and so on.
Mm.
And it's a big hanging that's in the church. And I think it's just, it shows us as a community. But it also, I think, when we coming back to what Beth was saying about that whole female thing, it's a female work of art within the church as well, because it's female. That's lovely.
It's certainly a tension for me doing women's work. Because I'm like, I'm doing theology and I want to sit at the table with the boys.
Yep.
And yet I find myself there telling women's stories, most often the stories I'm drawn to in scripture, using women's work, but still being like, but I'm coming to the table, boys.
Well, it doesn't, it's both and.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And for me, these are the voices I want to amplify. These are the voices I find amplified when I read the scripture. Yeah, so it is a gap to find. But I think for me it's also very much an act of trust. I cannot control how people respond to these images or what they think of them or any of those things, and I'm stuck with that. That's the trust I have to enact in God, that God's doing God's work and I'm just offering my abundance, for gleaning.
That's
just lovely. Thank you. It was nice to be in a room with scholars. I was like, come on now.
Thank you.
No problem.
So, again, chance to catch up with Miriam.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I'm very happy to show
you the time that you can start with Jesus, which is my favourite. I think it's gone by. Has it gone to stand by? Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened to the
Right, while Bruce sets up, we're now moving into labyrinths. So if you blink, you're on a different subject.
That's right,
lots of riches. So
is walking a labyrinth a bit like stitching?
Over to me already. You guys are remarkably on time. So we might just, because there are others are just sort of.
Yeah,
what is the? What's
no,
it?
You're very.
Quite impressive. Now, if anyone wants to go elsewhere, please.
Want to go to the pub.
Yeah, then that's fine. We'll just give it a minute, and I'll work out what I'm going to say. So. Are you? Yeah, do we? Righto. Well, just
are you ready?
No. but oh, that's right. No, you know, either. well, because I'm just still making it up. Oh, let's just do that. It'll do. We'll make something happen.
Are you sure you're ready?
No, I'm not.
You're not.
So let's start.
I have much time.
No,
right.
No.
Bruce is not ready.
No. But it doesn't mean I will be, though.
But because I've been told I keep everybody in
that. And you're doing a fabulous job.
I am going to continue. So.
Have we got a time? Okay. Where's the clock? Where's the clock gone? Here.
I can wave at you or
no, that's all right.
Right, is everybody else ready? Apart from Bruce, who's not
ready. we've got lunch at 12:40, right?
We've got enough time.
Yeah.
Okay, over to you, Bruce.
Oh, thank you, Maxine. Hello, everyone. Hello, my name is Bruce Holm, and I've been an academic working here at Table for the last 15 years, began 20 years as a student. And so I've been on a bit of a journey in engaging in finding out what it is that I'm passionate about and discovering a way I can get paid for it, which I've been lucky enough to do, and do some research in and around that. And in short, what I've been chipping away at over these past years is some sort of intersection between practical theology, or I like to call it practicing theology. It's more verb than noun. The doing of theology and meaning making. Spirituality, formation. I'm formed as a spiritual director. I've headed up a spiritual direction program. So that gives you a bit of a sniff of my kind of ilk and the things that I'm kind of interested in. Basically, I'm interested in how do we notice God and join in is kind of the basic gist. And so what I ended up doing out of my doctoral work, which conveniently intersected with a semester one unit that I taught for 15 years. So I had a bunch of willing guinea pigs. Well, they weren't willing, but they had no choice because they needed it to finish their course. And that was a unit on reflective practice or theological reflection. And so I did action research and basically ended up with a model and approach called talking the walk. We all want to walk our talk. We all want to practice what we preach, live with integrity. But first, we have to learn how to talk our walk, to make sense of our journey, that kind of thing. So talking and walking, very important for me. And so I ended up with three pillars to ground our reflective practice, three things that we want to kind of, before we set off talking our walk, three things we want to put in our backpack to get established, and they are the notion of holistic formation, the dimensions of that. What we're doing reflective practice for is in and towards shalom, so it's got a teleological or an eschatological kind of vision about it. So it's for the shalom, flourishing of self, others and world. And so that's about the dimensions, that's about the direction, and then I wanted a design, something that was going to shape it, okay? And that design gives shape to these three movements. One is contemplative conversation, one is imaginative discernment, and one is courageous embodiment. And they would look familiar from the themes of the conference. So what I want to just talk a little bit about in a snapshot is just a little bit about the design, okay? Does that make sense? So without all of that, This is kind of pivotal for me. So I wanted to argue that reflective practice needs to be well designed, because what I kind of found in the literature was sort of dry models and circles and things, and I kind of wanted something that would get under students' skin and get into our bones a little bit about more than just, oh, I ought to go and do some theological reflection. Where's that model? Something that actually changes our disposition in the way that we make meaning of the world, the way we see the world and make sense of it and notice God to join in. So for me, I wanted to engage the whole person. Metaphor and muscle, not just cognition and concept. I wanted something that could appeal to the imagination, to have a sense of living into the story in which we find ourselves. I wanted something that had simplicity, yet depth. And one of my markers for this, one of my methodologies was it had to be able to stretch my master's students, and I had to be able to do it with my boys on the way to school. Okay, so I sort of swung between those two poles. And if they could remember it, my boys could remember it, but it could still stretch my master's students. I thought, oh, we're kind of being able to flex along that continuum. And yeah, this whole thing, I wanted to invite into a way of being, an orientation not just a vending machine sort of steps to follow. Oh, how I need to discern. Where's that book, 10 Irrefutable Rules for Discernment? Ah, you know. So I didn't want to, because I want to treat God relationally. I want to see God's face, not just God's hand in that sense. So they were kind of my things that I wanted to engage with. So I landed on two resources, and what I wanted to tell is a little bit of the story about how those resources came together, and then get us to think about the ways that we can creatively juxtapose those resources from the Christian tradition and from other sources as well, as a way of creating pathways for meaning-making for the modern seeker. So one story was the Emmaus story. I was always drawn to this. I just thought this just makes so much sense. And of course, it's been mined and mined and mined and mined a lot in a lot of different contexts, supervision models, counselling models, etc. But there was just something magnetic about it for me. And one of the things that I ended up doing was changing this little word here from road two. To via or rode through Emmaus, because it struck me that the whole point is not to get to the table and have some wonderful revelation and go, isn't this great? But actually the return trip to Jerusalem is incredibly important. To point that out, and I won't go through this in detail, but you would know that the two volumes that Luke writes, Luke and Acts, are written or structured geographically. Yeah, you know how Luke structures the whole thing. He starts out wide, and it all centres on Jerusalem as the pinch point. So Luke is a theologian of formation. He wants to do this catecheo, this catechesis, this formation work. That's why he's telling the story. And we have Jesus after his initial part in the first four chapters. He starts his ministry in Galilee, winds around there for a bit, and then you get this pivotal point at 9:51 where Jesus sets his face towards Jerusalem. Sets his face towards Jerusalem. And then everything's about getting to Jerusalem. And so then from 1928 through to Acts 7:60, even though Jesus has risen, in a sense, that's where the action is happening. That's where this ministry is happening. And then, of course, you've got in 1 verse 8, the disciples being witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and all the ends of the earth. And that's kind of how it plays out and it expands out. So you've got this sense of Luke working, I've got to remember my year 9 physics, centripetally in towards the pinch point of Jerusalem, and centrifugally, I don't know, whatever it is, out, spins out. So it spins in, then it spins out. So this is very important for Luke. And so right in the middle, right at this pinch point, you've got this amazingly intimate account of what's happening with these two disciples. One we know the name of, one we don't. And they're heading the wrong way, because everything's been spinning towards Jerusalem and everything's been spinning out. But right here, they're heading in the wrong direction. And so that's what makes the encounter so powerful, because Jerusalem is going to be the launch pad of how shalom, God's flourishing, comes to come into the world from that point. So that's one of the main reasons that I like to say road via or road through Emmaus rather than to, because in our perception we think, oh, the story's just about getting to the table and having the revelation. Actually, Luke is wanting to say, how is this going to get legs? And how will the resurrected Jesus take root in the lives of people and be actually embodied? How is it going to land? And that's the whole thing about courageous embodiment. So from that, as my noticing about those three movements of the passage. By the way, the other thing I wanted to do was just extend the passage to verse 49. I kind of felt like if we just go to verse 35, so I don't know if you kind of got this in your head, it's probably a bit rough just trying to pull up the numbers, but 13 Luke 24:13-27 is the road to what's happening. 28-32 is what happens at the meal table. And then traditionally, oh, and by the way, they just rush back to Jerusalem. That's like 33-35. But if you look at verse 36, it says, even as they were still talking, what were they still talking about? Saying he was made known in the breaking of the bread. Yeah, Peter saw him, yeah. You'd think, oh, this is hunky-dory. What could be better than for Jesus to show up? But verse 36, even as they were still talking, Jesus comes and says, Shalom, peace be with you. And what happens? They go, yeah. No, they're petrified. And so that's where Jesus embarks on a ministry of courage giving, because this has got to be embodied and actually land. How is it going to spin out on the way out from Jerusalem? So Jesus embarks on this ministry of courage giving through, you know, touch my hands, let me tell you the story of God again. Oh, by the way, the Spirit's coming. So that's why I wanted to extend this story to verse 49. Okay, and from that, so I get the first part, the road to Emmaus, this cloaked, mysterious companion, this listening companion, this companion who doesn't go, oh, let me tell you what you're talking about, I already know it, or, hey, wait up, guys, come back, come on, it's me, I'm here. He says, what are you talking about? What do you mean, what are you talking about? All the things that have happened. What things? So there's no shortcuts to meaning-making. So Jesus listens them into speech in deep contemplative conversation. And what's happening in meaning-making? They're relying on clues. They're drawing from clues. Oh, the backstory of Israel. And we stood still, feeling sad. But we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel. And, oh, let me tell you about the scriptures and what the scriptures promise about the Messiah, etc. Then we come to, of course, the famous scene at the table, at Emmaus, communing with and discerning the revealed Jesus. And this is where the clues, all those clues that they're discussing and talking about, they give way or they give over to a larger reality. It's a little bit like, you know, you're joining dots on a dot to dot. You know that point where you're going from one number to another, then you go, oh, I can see what it is. You're not actually looking at the dots anymore. They're not talking about the women going to the tomb anymore. They're looking at, it's him. And what catalyzes that is the imagination, breaking of the bread. It's almost like, you know, Jesus breaks the bread and bang, 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 bang. You know, what is it? Is it Jesus saying, I'm the bread of life? Is it the feeding of the 5,000? Is it all the times they've eaten together? Is it the Last Supper? Who knows? It's probably all of those. But something, the imagination catalyzes or crystallizes this discernment. And then, and this is my thing, it's got to be embodied somehow. How is this new? They've got new eyes to see the world. There's been something deeply transformative. And so that whole part from 33 through to 49 is all about submitting to that reality. So I'm sharing this at a workshop during my thesis and just talking about it with a group of pastors. And we're talking about the backwards and forwards of the narrative and how it's going and how they're trying to live this reality out. And then there's a pause in the conversation. And one of these pastors says, oh, it's kind of like a labyrinth, isn't it? And I have my own bang, 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 bang. I go, oh, my goodness. The whole narrative is not linear. When you hear road to Emmaus, like, what do you think? Like, it's just straight. Look at the narrative. Look at the actual text. Look how it winds all the way into the centre of discernment. And look at the narrative if you've push it out to verse 49, it's not straightforward. And who's ever said, oh, I know what's true, I'm going to embody it, and it's straightforward? You know, it's like ABC. So in Western thinking, we tend to think A to B, don't we? And this is more like A to B to A dash. They come back and they encounter their own Jerusalem. The Jerusalem, the situation is the same, but it's actually different. And so that's what clued me into this notion of a labyrinth where you can feel lost, but you can't get lost. Nothing's wasted. An openness to surprise and mystery and individual journey. And so there's lots of different...
Hey? That's the other thing.
It's slow.
It's not like you don't just walk straight to the centre and straight out again.
That's it. Maxine.
For me, it's important because I'm a very fast pace.
Just hold on to that. That's a really helpful point. So in summary, what I ended up doing was combining these two resources to form a model for meaning making. And an interesting thing happened when I was getting bored with doing my PhD one afternoon. Is I looked at the length of 13 to 27. And I looked at the length of 33 to 49, and I discovered that they were the same length, remarkably. And then I started toying with the labyrinth. And then I discovered, magically, weirdly, it's the same distance on the way in as it is on the way out. So this, that's what you might have seen the image in the room. That's what this is about. Can have a look at it if you want. Yeah, this became for me a good way of thinking about these three movements, but visually, and to get students and get us to read the text in a non-linear fashion that clued into these three movements, but reminded us that both our life journeys are not linear, and the process of meaning making is not linear either. So when we think about Christian spirituality as a pathway for the modern seeker, that's kind of helpful for us to remember. So there's a whole bunch of stuff to think about. This might prompt some questions or discussion, but I'm thinking about a couple of things. What invitations or possibilities emerge for you in your spheres of influence from these theory themes? Where do you see these possibly helping, enriching your intersection with people who might be on the way and on the journey? And this is what I'm interested in. Can you think of other examples where resources from the Christian story creatively intersect with something from elsewhere to invite seekers to walk a pathway towards flourishing? So that's like a big dump. I would like just in twos or threes, just in groups, just to ponder, or it could be something else. But, you know, what strikes you, what opens possibilities for you, what forms a resonance for you in other ways of other things you've seen. So, or you can answer none of those questions. But you can just to ponder with that's all right. Just to ponder with other people for a little bit, and then we'll have a thought. Yeah. All right. It's probably a little bit cruel just to pull you back, but one comment from this table. Anybody want to volunteer something that sort of came out?
We just left that same journey from somewhere to elsewhere to being a seeker, and those three key pieces with the Jesus encounter with the Samaritan woman. Michael was sort of, he was the one who drew us back to those three things, but actually each of those three things happens for her too.
Isn't that beautiful?
So she's going somewhere, yes. She has an encounter, she ends up returning.
That's really good. That's very good.
Leaving her pot behind.
Her pot is in the middle of the labyrinth. Yeah. Thank you.
And the links in the gospel where all these
it's gorgeous.
When they encounter Jesus, is something they leave behind.
It's beautiful.
They leave their text collecting.
Thank you.
She leaves her pot.
Thank you.
She's serving for something.
Anything from Sally and Jenny?
I'm just wondering, I'm seeing a lot of parallels with the indigenous way of being and not linear, which frustrates me. I'm a very linear person. But the artwork on that, is that an indigenous artist?
I worked with our graphic designer here, but I really wanted the colours. I went and consulted an indigenous artist to see what she felt, what she thought and what she felt about a white fella, because I wanted to say there's something about richer about indigenous culture and knows a lot more about walking and talking than I do. And she was so affirming, and I thought, okay, I would like to do this. So that's why we particularly connected with that.
The background.
The background and those colours, yeah.
You're almost navigating by song, aren't you? It's like a song.
It's like a song line.
Isn't
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Anything from this table?
Actually, one of the things I think that also came from our musings was where we've got imaginative discernment, part of me goes, there's such a courage that we also need. We talk about courage as embodiment.
Yes.
Yet I feel that the courage also has to come into how we imagine.
Yes.
And how we imagine possibilities. And entwined with that courage is openness.
Yes.
As we were saying, we can put a lot of fear and boxing, which then constricts our imagination.
Beautiful. Thank you. Off the back, anything from either of you? Sometimes God does take a long time to act suddenly, and it will feel slow, then all of a sudden it comes in a rush. But yeah, up the back here, anything from you guys at all that you want to offer? Lovely. And over here, anything you'd like to offer at all?
I've always been taken, and I'm sorry to go through all those questions, but taken by the hospitality that those people showed Jesus by welcoming him.
Yes.
And only because of that, then they were opened to his presence. And I think that said, oh, lovely to have been with you and what you sense, great. See you tomorrow or goodbye on this day. You know, that would not happen. So hospitality to welcome Christ and welcome God into your lives is probably the key.
Beautiful. Thank you. I've written a summary paper. It'll be up. It's of the whole project, but yeah, thank you very much for engaging.
Not too bad, considering that you weren't ready.
Well, you know, I'm going to think of a few other things anyway. Thank you. Thank you.